Aloha, I'm Russell Subiono, and for Catherine Cruz, thanks for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Thursday, October 31st. Potentially scary times for union workers. While a nursing lockout on Oahu ended after 18 days earlier this month, nurses on Maui and Lanai are gearing up for a strike of their own. What could be lurking in Hawaii's flora? A new survey looks at the threats invasive plants could be posing to our landscape. And we revisit a spooky conversation with the ghost guy, Lopaka Kapanui. Plus, the Night Marchers take center stage in a new horror fantasy novel. Get ready for the heebie-jeebies, island style. It's Halloween. Get the costumes and candy ready. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Russell Subiono, in for Catherine Cruz. While the nurses at Oahu's Kapiolani Medical Center for Women and Children reached an agreement on a new contract earlier this month, ending an 18-day lockout, strikes in the healthcare sector are far from over. On Maui and Lanai, nurses plan to begin a strike this Monday. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel tells us more. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Russell. So about 900 union healthcare workers on Maui and Lanai, as you said, are preparing to strike. Their contracts expired last month, and they've been in negotiations since July for months and months now with Maui Health. And so Maui Health is under Kaiser Permanente. They are affiliated with Kaiser, but they are a separate entity from Kaiser. And Maui Memorial Medical Center operates independently as a community-based hospital. Planned strikes are at three different locations. So Maui Memorial Medical Center, Kulo Hospital, as well as Lanai Community Hospital. And those strikes are planned as of now from Monday until Thursday, so 3 days of strikes. And during leading up until that time, negotiations are ongoing between the union and Maui Health, and so everyone is hoping that they'll reach an agreement and not have to strike. Maui Memorial is the island's only acute care facility, and according to one bargaining team member that I spoke with, just for comparison, Queens on Oahu has about 56,000 ER visits annually, and Maui Memorial has 51,000 per year. And so just thinking about that volume is really high. Lanai Community Hospital is the island's only hospital there. It is staffed by only one nurse at a time, and so those services are critical as well. They have several bargaining sessions scheduled from now through Sunday, and the primary issues here are wages and safe staffing ratios. And so the bargaining team has proposed some of the same staffing ratios that Kaiser has agreed to in their contract with California nurses. And wages as well, you know, we've heard so much about the high cost of living, the availability of housing on Maui, and staff are really just struggling to you know, live and continue working on Maui. Employees at Maui Memorial say they make 10 to 30% less than the same classification jobs at Kaiser Clinic right down the road. And so it is a little bit hard to imagine, you know, that they're sort of left feeling like second class citizens, even with the critical services that they provide. So the union that we're talking about here is the United Nurses and Healthcare Employees of Hawaii. And again, they represent about 900 employees across the board. So registered nurses, social workers, imaging, MRI, clerks, receptionists, really quite a wide range. Doctors are not included in this right now. So those doctors will remain on staff during in the event of a strike. Napua Aloy is a labor and delivery nurse at Maui Memorial, and she talks about how personal all of this is for her.
It's definitely a personal struggle because I am rooted here. and I love what I do, and I love, you know, love working in the department I do work at. So, and being that I was born and raised here, I was born there, my family was born there, my husband was born there. It kind of came full circle for me in terms of giving back now to my community, serving as a capacity as a nurse there. So it definitely is a personal situation, not just for me, but also for the community that I'm from. It makes us who we are. So the dilemma we've been dealing with is coming up to the forefront of losing some of the nurses that have come here, nurses that may have been born here as well, or nurses that have traveled here, becoming difficult for them to keep up with the cost of living. So with that being said, you know, we lost some nurses to Kaiser Clinic. We lost some nurses that decided to move here and they returned to their hometown because they aren't unable to sustain their families here. So that's what we're at the forefront. And for me, I'm going to be here. I'm going to retire here. And at this point, we kind of had to take a stand in terms of fighting for not just our nurses, but our workers that are there that are in the fight with us, and also for our community to provide them the best that we can provide. But we can't do that if we don't have enough staffing.
Wow, yeah, that's got to be so tough. What about the staffing during the strike?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the issues. What happens to patients when they come in during the strike, right? As we saw with Kapiolani, Aloy got really emotional talking about that. And, you know, working in the labor and delivery department, you know, thinking about the moms that are going to come in to deliver their babies while she's not there to help them. But, you know, she stresses that this is for the long-term good of the community, being able to sustain services into the future, and she hopes that the community will understand. Maui Health has said that they have contingencies in place. Should the strike move forward, all facilities will remain open, and so they are stressing that service will continue as usual during the strike. Rowan Funes is an ER nurse at Maui Memorial, as well as a member of the bargaining team, and he talks about what that process has been like so far.
Up until this last week, it was a process of us giving proposals, basically, on various topics, and the response has been pretty much wholeheartedly either no response or just straight no to the proposals. Like they'll line it out. For example, the two main issues that we're actually bargaining for, which is important to our members, is ratios. Ratios is the max amount of patients a nurse can get based on acuity, so based on how sick they are. We don't have any type of ratio laws here in Hawaii like they do in California. And we're trying to keep the ratios at a respected, you know, amount for safety of the patients and for the staff. We had a whole ratio proposal of about 5 pages on the first week of bargaining. And they basically, their response to that the following week was they just basically went onto Microsoft Word and they put a line, they striked out every sentence on those 4 pages and then replied that, you know, management will reserve the right to staff appropriately per, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, they're basically saying that they can just staff whatever they want.
All right, so we've heard from the nurses' side. What's been the response from Maui Health in all of this?
Yeah, so Maui Health says that bargaining teams, you know, have been meeting in 18 or 19 bargaining sessions over the past 14 weeks. And they said that they have successfully reached tentative agreements for almost all of the non-economic articles. And so they said that this progress will allow them to focus upcoming bargaining sessions on those wages, benefits, and staffing. They say that they do remain committed to good faith bargaining efforts. They, you know, hope to move forward and reach those agreements. And again, they did say in the event of a strike, quote, we have comprehensive plans in place to help ensure the best possible care for our patients, residents, and communities we serve on Maui and Lanai. Our hospitals, emergency departments, and clinics are open and will remain open and operating as usual, unquote. They did add that they, you know, they value and respect all of their employees, and those employees represent, you know, the heart of safe and high-quality care, and they, you know, they hope, obviously, for a positive outcome in all this. Stephanie Castro works as a clinical staff at the outpatient portion of Maui Memorial. So again, it doesn't just affect nurses, it affects, you know, clinical staff as well. And she just talked about, again, you know, just the hardship of having to have two or three jobs, you know, just to be able to afford working there. Again, their high rate of staff turnover. And Rowan Funes with the bargaining team, you know, says he's confident they won't have a lockout situation like they did with Kapiolani recently. But, you know, hopefully we'll see in the next few days here how negotiations go and, you know, if the strike will move forward next week.
Hopefully both parties can come to the table and come to an agreement before Monday. I know this impacts nurses and patients alike, so please keep us updated on the developments as they happen.
We will, for sure. Thanks, Russell.
Great. Thanks so much, Catherine. We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. She covers our Maui Nui stories. You can read more of those stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Asset School in Honolulu, focused on educating K to 12th grade students who are gifted and with dyslexia or other language-based learning differences. Private tours available at assets-school.org.
Younger workers in Portugal are leaving the country in droves. High rents and low wages are pushing them out. The government introduced new tax breaks to get them to stay, but
to be honest, these measures are coming a little bit too late. If they really want to fix the country, they have a long road ahead.
Brain drain in Portugal, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
HPR listeners value public radio. If you're looking for a way to connect with our audience, help our fans get to know your company by sponsoring programming on HPR. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/corporate support.
Later this hour, we'll be hanahoeing spooky ghost stories from Lopaka, the ghost guy Kapa Nui. But you don't need to leave this plane of existence to experience a fright. The Hawaii Department of Agriculture is currently on the hunt for creepy, crawly, invasive plant diseases. Think fungi, bacteria, and even worms that might be affecting our crops, but have never been documented before in Hawaii. Plant pathologist Josiah Marquez is leading the survey, which is part of a nationwide effort from the USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the threats to our plants that could be lurking right under our noses.
As a child, I was always interested in growing food. I lived in California until I was 14, so there was enough land to grow a little vegetable garden, and that's basically where I started. And when we moved to Hawaii, we had a yard at the time, and it was in Kaneohe, which was quite green and wet. So it was very easy to grow things, and it was a lot of fun. I think I developed a interest in agriculture, and specifically plants that produce food. Got my bachelor's in tropical plant and soil science, then master's in PEPS, which is plant environmental protection sciences. And I went to Georgia, finally, with my doctorates in plant pathology. And then, thankfully, was able to return back home and get this job as a plant pathologist at the Department of Ag.
Plant pathology, which is fancy speak for plant diseases, basically.
Yeah.
All the different diseases plants can get.
Yeah. Actually, that's what the survey projects are. Early detections of these invasive species, we can call it, that we want to prevent from spreading throughout the state, also preventing entry of these pathogens.
When we talk about a plant pathogen, that can be fungus, bacteria.
Yeah.
Can plants get viruses?
Yes, yeah. Oh, you named like three of the four groups. Nematodes.
Nematodes.
Yeah.
Yes, I should have. Worms are always on my mind.
Okay. So what's commonly thrown out there is about 85% of the plant diseases are caused by fungal pathogens. And that's usually followed by bacteria, then viruses, and nematodes. So I'm actually trained as a nematologist, and I think nematodes are usually overlooked because they're below ground most of the time. So I think for warmer climates like Hawaii, nematodes are definitely a bigger issue.
Do we have like a working estimate for how many pathogens might be affecting some of Hawaii's major crops?
Yeah, I can't think of any reports or data I can share, but I think those who are in agriculture in Hawaii know that the top issues for growing is pests and disease. It's true worldwide, but it's definitely true for climates where there's no winter, because usually the winter is what resets everything, where all the disease, all the pests, they're dying off and they're in their survival stage and their population numbers are very low. But in Hawaii and other tropical regions, the pest pressure, the disease pressure, it's always pretty high.
So to pivot to talk about this survey that you're doing, could you lay out what the survey entails, kind of what you're looking for, and yeah, what your work over the coming months will look like?
This type of survey is actually funded by USDA APHIS. They have a list of pests that they call national priority pests. And they're wanting every state to conduct these surveys for the purpose of early detection, so we can, I guess, detect it early and eradicate it, hopefully, before it spreads and gets established. But the other purpose is to provide negative data, actually, to show evidence that we don't have these national priority pests. So the survey I'm doing targets these national priority pests. But they do make some room to include some other pathogens that I think are relevant for Hawaii that may not be on that list. I included one pathogen for coffee and one for cacao, because I think they're important crops, that none of the national priority pests are going to threaten those crops. For coffee, I'm targeting the coffee berry disease. It's a fungal pathogen, and it infects the beans, and that's where it's a serious pathogen. They can actually infect, I guess, the green beans when they're not mature yet. So yeah, they can reduce yields. So it's only been reported in Africa and China. Yeah, that's definitely one that I think we all need to look out for. On top of that, I believe Hawaii Department of Ag should be doing their own surveys too, just for common diseases that are out there, just to kind of get a baseline, like, database of all the diseases that are present here and what their distribution is like. So that I'm also just wanting to visit farms so I can just collect as many disease samples as possible and just build a database of what is here in Hawaii.
When you're talking about negative data and this idea of collecting a baseline, it made me think of something that scientists say all the time, which is that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And basically all that is to say, of if you don't have the data, we can't say for sure that these things aren't here.
Yeah, true. It's not, I guess, conclusive, but at least it's something. At least there's effort being made to look for these national priority pests. And the purpose of these surveys is not a one-time thing, but like something that you do regularly throughout. It could be done every year. And I think that is what they want.
That's new for ag to be doing.
They used to do it, actually. I think Hawaii Department of Ag is struggling right now. There's a lot of vacant positions, and they used to have a survey team at one time, but there's no longer a survey team.
And so now you're the survey team?
Yeah, right now I'm the only one doing surveys.
And so what do these farm visits look like? How are they coordinated and scheduled, and day of, what are you doing when you go to this farm?
Basically, I just visit the farmer and he like shows me his fields. It's that simple. I don't try to look at everything. All the survey work is visual inspections. I'm not going to just sample some systematic way, asymptomatic or just healthy looking plants. I'm just looking for symptoms out in the field. I think the more important part of doing these surveys is to connect with these growers, and they know that there's someone that they can reach out to if they do see something strange. And ultimately, I think that's where we're going to get early detections, is from growers reporting it.
Yeah, so trying to create this like early surveillance network.
Yes, yeah.
So growers will kind of point and say, oh, here's my plant. It looks kind of weird. From there, you know, do you write it down? Do you take a photo? How do you diagnose what might be going on?
Yeah, I will always have to take a sample, actually, and bring it to the lab. And then we process the sample and do all the tests that's required for each of the priority pests. Fungal pathogens tend to be easier. A lot of times, their spores are unique enough that you can identify at least a genus level. But, you know, these days, to get confirmation on a specific species, you really have to use molecular tools like PCR. And this is another crazy thing. So currently, I can't do those tests. That's, I think, because, yeah, Department of Ag has kind of not kept up. But I'm working on it. I think it's possible. Soon, it'll be possible. But in the meantime, I have to collaborate with research labs at University of Hawaii.
Could this be a win-win both for ag and for individual growers, that by participating in this survey, they might get more information on any potential issues with their plants that otherwise
might not know? That's what I'm hoping for, that as I do the survey, growers feel comfortable sending me samples whenever they know something that they think is a disease. Actually, when I'm visiting these fields, I hope to encounter other pathogens that are not on that list that I'm targeting, so that I can learn about, you know, what is actually out here and build a database that we can use for risk assessments and policy making. So I do welcome anyone to send me samples, actually. I only get overwhelmed when I bring my own samples, but I haven't gotten a lot of public samples. And that's mainly because people don't know about me.
Do you have an internal goal in mind of how many samples total you're looking to get in this survey, or how many?
Yeah, we made the bar quite low, which was 10 fields for each of the priority pests. So I only need 10 fields statewide, but I do hope to be comprehensive as much as possible. I'll just try my best, just reach out to as many farms as possible until someone tells me we have no more money to travel.
Well, is there anything that listeners, particularly listeners who might be involved in the agricultural industry, whether it's as a grower or processor at some other stage, what should they know about your survey?
It's helpful. This would help the whole agriculture community prevent the spread of any new disease that potentially entered the state. But it's also, I think, can help the grower learn about the disease that they have in their farm and better manage the disease they currently have as well.
That was Josiah Marquez of the Hawaii Department of Agriculture talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about his ongoing invasive plant survey. We'll have links to a field guide for some of these priority pathogens and more information on how growers can get involved in the survey on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Former president certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure. I think he'd love to be just like he was in business. He could tell people to do things and they would do it and not really bother too much about what the legalities were.
Never in American history have so many former presidential staffers issued such a dire warning about the man they used to work for. Are Americans listening? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
You're curious. You're eager. You're busy. HPR can help you stay in the loop with the new Akamai Recap. It's a quick roundup of local news stories sent to your inbox every weekday afternoon. Stay informed in one handy email by signing up at hawaiipublicradio.org/akamai.
Thank you.
Have you ever thought a ghost might be in the room with you? Well, here at The Conversation, we were told once that our studio might be haunted. And the person who told us? Master storyteller Lopaka Kapanui. Kapanui grew up hearing old legends and ghost stories from his aunties in Kupuna. He's been collecting these stories for over 30 years. He shares them in performances and on walking tours through some of the darkest, spookiest places where he explains why certain sites may be haunted. His reputation as a paranormal storyteller has earned him the nickname the Ghost Guy. The Conversation's Lillian Song got the chance to sit down with him in our studio in 2022. He starts by explaining what happens at a typical show.
People will arrive to the venue not realizing that they also have their departed ancestors with them. And what might happen, even before I can begin, their departed ancestors will come on the stage and approach me and tell me, "That's my granddaughter over there. Can you tell her to start gardening?" A lot of times in different venues where I'm telling ghost stories, people's departed loved ones will literally hijack the show and not let me do anything until I at least relay two or three messages to their living members in the audience. So when people are sitting in the audience and I look out there, I can see that certain people have, you know, spirits with them, sometimes family, other things. And a lot of times, you know, it's fine. I get through the show. You know, we have fun. But other times I will see the spirit of a person who belongs to that living person in the audience, and I'll see them start to get up like this. I'm like, "Oh, my God." And they'll just run up on stage and tell me, "Tell her, go back to Kauai because she hasn't seen me in 5 or 6 years, you know, and she hasn't visited my grave." And that's what I have to do. I have to acknowledge at least two or three of them before I can get started. And sometimes the spirits that are attached to the theater also decide to show up as well. The beauty of bringing that experience into a theater setting is, you know, we're not out in the open. There's no ambient noise or people to distract the process. And so being in a theater, it's four walls, everyone's contained, and they can't go anywhere for an hour and a half. And so I have their complete attention. My job as a storyteller is to be transformative, to literally transform them to the place that I'm talking about, you know, and have them feel all the emotions, smell the smells, all of that stuff.
So you are sharing the history of Hawaii, telling these stories of people that went on already.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a story.
Are you sure?
Okay. Well, let's keep in mind we are public radio. Maybe something to give us a taste, an experience of what you do.
Yeah, so there's those banyan trees between the old State ID building and Ali'iulani Hale in that parking lot. Coming down Punch Bowl, you pass the State Library, you pass the intersection, it's that first right turn behind the bus stop. Mm-hmm. What I found out is that when the Chinese, Eastern Indians, and the Filipinos brought their own variety of ficus or banyan to Hawaii, over the years, you know, local people begin to realize there's a similarity, and that is the further out the branches spread, the more they're able to latch on to these spirits of the restless dead, dark, shadowy human figures with red glowing eyes. In the Philippines, it's often referred to as balete, the banyan tree. And so there's a belief that after the services for a departed one, sometimes they will wrap the body in fiber made from pineapple, and they'll place the body within the confines of a balete or a banyan tree, because now that body is for or belongs to the gods or the spirits that live in those balete, those banyan trees. Last year around this time, I realized by one of my sheriff friends that once a month they have to show up and do overnight duty because electricians, for some strange reason, once a month have to go to the basement of the old State ID building and fix stuff because the electricity is going haywire. And the sheriffs have told me, when they originally started doing this, they would park under the banyan tree, but then they learned a lesson. And the lesson was they would hear what sounded like long fingernails tapping on the window. And they would look out, and there wouldn't be anything physical there, but they swore they could see a shadow. And other times when they're standing outside the squad car, just hanging out, having conversations. They said they look up into the branches of those banyan trees, and they can literally see large shadowy figures moving through the branches, like one through the other. And sometimes the sheriff will say he will hear the disembodied voice whisper his name, but it's only the name his mom calls him. Sometimes they'll feel a hand go through their hair like this. One of the electricians told me he was downstairs one night on the ladder, screwing in a new light fixture, and he said his son was holding down the bottom part of the ladder so he wouldn't fall. And he said while he's doing this, screwing in the light fixture, he feels two thumbs insert itself into the waistband of his pants, sort of adjust it, and then pull it up because his pants was beginning to fall down. He was so scared, he nearly fell off the ladder and was more upset that his son wasn't holding the ladder. And so he's screaming for his son, and he realizes afterwards that the son never actually came down with him. He left the truck with all the stuff and assumed that his son had followed him, but his son had been sleeping in the truck the whole time. During that period, who was holding down the ladder? He said, I saw someone there holding it down, but who was it actually? The history of that building is that there's a cornerstone of that building that was laid by Governor Wallace Ryder Farrington. He was a Freemason, and so that's actually a Masonic cornerstone. What we find out later is that after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, you know, there are so many bodies, they ran out of room for them to store on base. So the basement of that old CID building was the temporary morgue during that time. So there's that.
There is that spiritual history of the deceased. It was a repository.
Yeah.
And another site that comes to mind is Hele Moa in Waikiki.
So what's there now, the former Hele Moa Heo is part of the Royal Hawaiian Shopping Center, but also the hotel itself. And there's an article from the 1800s where Mr. Damon is directing a bunch of Japanese labor workers to uproot and cut down all those ancient trees planted by Kakui Hewa. And so the Japanese laborers are working. It's about noon. They take a break. And what's happening is the way in which they're trying to uproot those trees is sort of difficult. And so that's why they have to stop and take a break. And the article says that some of the men are returning and that there was a fish pond in that area that grew a moi fish. And this wind comes through the place. It's just wrecking everything. And Mr. Damon hears all these Japanese men screaming and running for their life. And what's happening is somehow the wind has upended these coconut trees that the roots at the bottom are coming up like catapults. But what they're catapulting are human remains, skeletons caught within the roots of those old kumunio, those coconut trees. And Mr. Damon, to his horror, witnesses that these skulls and rib cages and femurs are catapulting like this and actually beating these Japanese labor workers as they're running away, catching them in the back of the head, you know. Bah! I can't name names, but certain staff at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel were horrified to know that this actually took place. There's also a night marchers procession going through the grounds of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel as well.
And you have so many stories. How do you collect them?
Reading, listening. But a lot of times people contact me through all types of mediums to share personal experience. And those are the best ones because they come from everyday people, especially people who work at jobs where they're not trained to think or believe in things like spirits, like police officers. So when someone tells me their personal experience, and what would usually be a 5-minute story takes them like almost an hour because there's so much emotion in it, you know, and they have to stop and gather themselves. Those are the best stories. And so when they give me permission to tell them, I want to make sure that I get everything correct because I don't want to insult their ancestors, you know, and their lineage. So I'm funny about the details.
With the details, you're allowing your audience to really see the story that you are sharing, putting us into a sense of history, into a sense of place. Are there similarities or are there really malevolent beings that you would then tell people to be mindful of? I think like the Pali, the Judd Trail was one where there were just a lot of deaths occurring.
Yeah. There's a lot more malevolent people than there are spirits. So when I also help make people aware of is that whatever does or doesn't happen at night has nothing to do with me, even though I'm the guy that's going to be, you know, waffling on for an hour and a half. I tell people, whatever happens tonight depends on you, because you're now here with all of your stuff, collectively, emotionally, physically, spiritually, like everything you have with you, all your stuff is here right now. And I said, that will determine what happens or doesn't happen. And I tell them, if, you know, you're here to see a ghost, you're going to be disappointed, because ghosts are only residual. It's like watching a recording. It's leftover human energy in a place that just plays itself back. So you shouldn't be afraid of a ghost, doesn't even know that you're there. So I tell them what you're hoping for is an encounter with something that's cognizant, that's aware that it's dead, it's aware it can't move on, but it's also aware of us. And I share with them that when a spirit like that is aware of a human being that is aware of it, that's when communication starts to happen. So it's not possession, it's not an attachment, it's clear communication. So if you and I are the only two people in a room full of, let's say, Rotarians, and we see each other across the room and we recognize each other, the first thing we want to do is communicate, say hi, or, you know, try at least to touch one another. Spirits work in that same way, but the reason they can't get through to us all the time is because as human beings, we're focused on job, family, relationships. So what that spirit will do is go to the person closest to you who's more receptive. So one person called me crying and she said, you know, my best friend from childhood, I had a dream that her mom came to me and the mom actually told me, can you tell her? I don't mind when she comes to leave food at the headstone, but please take it away. I hate the bugs. And so she says, I went to my friend and I told her the exact detail of what her mom told me in my dream. And you know what my friend said? What the hell? That's my mom. Why is she talking to you? She should be talking to me. Well, I told her that's because your friend's concentration is somewhere else. And so you're the only receptive person next to your friend. That's why the mom came to see you. So that sort of makes them feel, I don't know what the word is, responsible. It gives them this sort of hope, like, okay, they realize, wow, so I can do this or I cannot do this. You know, it's up to me.
That was master storyteller Lopaka Kapanui talking with The Conversations, Lillian Song, about the supernatural in Hawaii. Inspired by his mentor, the late Glenn Grant, Kapanui has been telling and collecting some of the island's spookiest stories for three decades. Do you think his ghost stories could be real? We'll let you be the judge. Kapanui is leading a Ghosts of Old Honolulu walking tour tonight, starting at 9 p.m., We'll share links on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding Hawaii residents that completed ballots must be received by 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 5th. Ballot drop box and voter service center locations at elections.hawaii.gov.
It's Halloween, which means it's time to scare ourselves on purpose by watching horror movies.
A lot of us, we find that kind of refreshing extreme, like, oh my gosh, okay, I feel more alive from watching extreme horror films.
I'm Ilse Chang. A horror filmmaker tells us her favorite films of the year on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
It costs money to bring you the news and music you depend on here on HPR. Becoming a monthly sustaining member is the easiest way to support your favorite programs. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The Hawaiian legend of the Night Marchers is featured in a new novel by horror fantasy writer J. Lincoln Fenn. She weaves the ghosts of ancient warriors into a story where the main character is sent to Hawaii to collect a rare flower and ends up on a path to solve a mysterious death. Fenn grew up on the East Coast, but later lived for a decade on Maui. I got the chance to talk to her about the book, also titled The Night Marchers, and whether she experienced the unexplained while living on the Valley Isle. Your book starts out with a series of letters written in the 1830s by the character Irene to her sister Liddy. Over the course of these letters, we track what seems to be Irene's deteriorating mental health and subsequent death under mysterious circumstances. I really like how you did this. It really sets the stage for the rest of the book. Can you share a little bit about the rest of the story?
Yes, the first chapter is in this letter form, and then we pick up the story with her great niece who's living in Los Angeles and is struggling. And then Irene, who was writing the letters to her sister is still around in Los Angeles and is a scientist into epigenetics and genetic engineering. And she kind of solicits her great niece to go to the island to collect her sister's remains and also to get a sample of a flower that Irene was very excited about. And she wants that sample.
I read that you grew up in New England and you now reside in Seattle, but at some point you lived on Maui. I imagine that's where you might have first heard about the Hawaiian legend of the Night Marchers. What led you to want to write a novel that included them?
Yeah, so I did. I lived on Maui for about 10 years. And as I was kind of evolving this idea of, you know, coming from New England where I grew up outside of a factory town, and, you know, there was a boom of employment and everything seemed fine. And then the factory left. And then we discovered there were a lot of chemicals in the environment and people started getting sick. So just in general, the idea of this sense of business wanting to go in and extract the natural resources for profit and then not understanding the impact of that activity and having experienced that on a really personal level. And then going to living on Maui and seeing, you know, a similar dynamic there where, you know, you have people going there for to extract the experience or to extract different kinds of things, but not really understanding the place and the beauty that exists there. And just kind of like the obstruction that's created when you're just solely focused on wealth or business and your stock prices, you know, what you're missing and what ultimately can be the consequences of that, unintended as they may be.
During your time on Maui, how did you encounter the legend? Was that something that you read in a book or something that somebody shared with you? What was your first experience with hearing about the Night Marchers?
So I think, I can't remember exactly where I ran across it, but I was interested in a lot of the kind of like the history and, you know, as a horror fantasy writer, anything related to mythology is always very interesting to me. So I gravitate to any kind of story like that, because I think sometimes they, you know, they're talking about things that are at a deeper level, and it's just through the lens of the story that you can kind of access that.
The Night Marchers are a significant part of the plot of the 2021 Netflix movie Finding Ohana. Did you happen to catch Finding Ohana? Did that depiction influence you in any way? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have not heard of that, but I think that the word that kind of was part of, so I was driving to work one day listening to the radio, and they were, you know, they would share like a word of the day. And so they shared the word kanu, and they said it was to bury in terms of burial, like burying a loved one, but also it meant to plant. And that kind of thought resonated with me, because I think, you know, in the culture I'm from, you bury something, it's gone, and it has no relation to you in the future. Whereas really, you know, everything is connected. So what you're burying is actually something is going to grow from that. And so that interested me. And then I could see some relation to the Night Marchers. And then also very interested in, you know, our idea of our control of our own mind and how we think we control it. But really, there's a lot of natural influences happening that are impacting us. So just, you know, the kind of Western idea that we are separate, we are this entity moving through the world, instead of we are a natural part of the world, and we are impacted by nature.
When it comes to your style of writing, or what makes your writing uniquely you, one of the things that stood out to me early is the way that Aunt Liddy reflects on her life in her letter to Julia, the letter that initially invites her into her home and into this journey that Julia goes on. You wrote phrases like, "We pass on generationally not only our physical traits, color of eyes, etc., but the sorrows of familial conflict." And you also wrote, "Nothing poisons quite so well as rejection." And "Things we bury have a way of digging their way out. They creep and clutch and bloom in our dark, shadowy places." As a writer, I'm always interested where these thoughts come from. You know, where do words like that originate, or thoughts or phrases like that originate? And how do you bring them out when you write?
You know, again, I think there's the causality of not respecting nature and how that impacts us. But I think there's also emotional trauma that gets passed on generation to generation. You know, and it's hard because sometimes we think, oh, these are bad people. They shouldn't have done this. But we're all human beings and we all make mistakes. And sometimes there are unintended consequences to our actions. And so it's kind of in the actual writing process. I think there's different thoughts that I'm having about the world and different observations. But when it comes to the actual writing, I try not to think about it too much, if that makes any sense, because it is a little bit of a spooky art. And if you like, I think when you're first starting out writing, you know, you write something and then you edit it and edit it and edit it and edit it. And then you just can't move past it. So learning how to have that balance of getting the work done and not getting in the way of it and just letting it be what it's going to be and not trying to dictate it in a certain kind of way. And I think that last sentence you wrote, I mean, that's basically the book. You know.
Yeah, "Things we bury have a way of digging their way out. They creep and clutch and bloom in our dark, shadowy places." I'm sure there's a lot of people here that could relate to that. In the acknowledgments at the back of your book, you thank the people of Maui for sharing their mana'o with you. Can you talk about your time living on Maui and how what they shared with you shaped your book?
So I think that coming to Maui from the mainland, you have a very two-dimensional view of what life is like, right? Because that's what comes through on the marketing. You know, getting to know people from all the different facets of the cultures on Maui and, you know, just being open and realizing, having a deeper appreciation and just accepting the pain kind of what my historical culture has done. In the island, it definitely informed the book and it's informed my life, to be honest with you. And, you know, just being able to see more clearly my own kind of culture and things that, you know, I think it's time we leave some of that behind. I don't think it's helping anybody. And I think that, you know, I was very, very touched on many deep levels of my personhood. And I always felt like I didn't feel like I was ever had to conform to anything in particular. I think it was like, as long as you're just yourself and you respect people and you're open-minded, there's a lot of friendship. And I miss folks for sure a lot.
I grew up hearing about the legend of the Night Marchers. Those stories are so ingrained in me that sometimes I can't tell definitely whether they exist or don't exist. And I have experienced some strange things in the middle of the night while camping out in Waipio Valley on the Big Island. So in my head, like, anything's possible. During your time on Maui, did you encounter anything strange or unexplained that maybe opened your mind to the possibility that the Night Marchers really do exist?
Well, I think I did have, and I think I've always had more of a openness to the mysterious experiences of life. And I just remember, I don't know, there were just places, it's hard to explain, but it's like, it might be a tree that you see. And there's just something about this one particular tree and it has so much energy and it just has this charisma and you just want to know what the story is of that tree, or it could be a pile of rocks, right? And I got senses to sometimes, like, if I felt like there was some place that I shouldn't be, for whatever reason, I just felt it was not a place where I should be, I would just leave. And it's hard to explain that to someone who doesn't have those kind of experiences. And then other places where, you know, for whatever reason, I felt like very much in tune and in aligned with whatever kind of energies were around me. So just learning how to listen to those feelings.
You know, I imagine many cultures, if not all of them, have stories and legends like the Night Marchers, like Madame Pele. Why do you think that these stories endure?
Because I think there's something that we can't approach intellectually. And I don't think we have a name for the sense that we have. But it's like there's something beyond what is known. And it's almost like, you know, if there's a balloon, you push your hand into the balloon and you feel something pushing back and you can't name it, but you know it's there. So we try to put names to things and to experiences because, you know, this logical brain of ours needs an explanation. So I think as I've gotten older, I'm just kind of like similar to my writing. I try not to name it or theorize or figure out what it is. It's the realm of the inexplicable.
Yeah, we know it's there, but we're not quite sure how to describe it or unsure that we should name it. The last thing I wanted to ask you was just, where can listeners get your book, The Night Marchers?
Ah, okay. Well, that is super, super easy. It is coming out in paperback form on the 29th, so Amazon or wherever it is. Well, actually, go to your local bookstore and support them. And if you don't find The Night Marchers there, to get another book because we need our bookstores. But it is online and it is also available ebook as well.
Awesome. Jay Lincoln Fenn, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate being able to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was author Jay Lincoln Fenn talking about her new book, The Night Marchers. It was published through Gallery Books and is available through online booksellers, but Fenn encourages readers to check out their local bookstore first. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show with some of our recent interviews related to World War II as we look ahead to Veterans Day on November 11th. Give us some feedback. Talk about or call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in for podcasts. I'm Russell Subiono. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation. Happy Halloween. Superstition.